Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism Liberation. Each week we bring you interviews and analysis on the struggles affecting poor and working people throughout the U.S. and the world, building the movement for socialism in the United States.
With Russia confirming sanctions this morning against Turkey and Germany officially joining the American-led anti-ISIS coalition, sending 1,200 military personnel as well as a naval frigate to the Middle East, the increasingly multi-sided war is deepening without any clear end in sight. And joining us here to discuss all of this, or maybe not all of it, there's so much to discuss, we have a lot to say, is Mr. Ben Becker joining us from the Answer Coalition. Mr. Becker, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So first and foremost, what I really wanted to talk about is what is the hot news this morning, which is the issue of Russia and Turkey. A lot of accusations flying back and forth. So Russia is alleging that the downing of the plane was essentially Turkey trying to protect its alliance with ISIS. And the LA Times also had an article this morning essentially saying the exact same thing, which I thought was interesting. How are you evaluating that?
Well, it's obviously a very heavy charge to be making. There's supposed to be an international coalition against ISIS, which Turkey says that it wants to be a part of. So for Russia to claim that Turkey's not only stabbing it in the back, but actually contradicting its own stated policy and supporting ISIS, it's a very big charge. Erdogan himself said that he would resign if there was any evidence to prove it. Although, of course, there is quite a bit of evidence to show that, look, ISIS is making lots of money off of oil. They got to be selling it somewhere. There's a large porous border with Turkey. Turkey sells lots of oil to the West. It sells it to Israel. So I think it's a big escalation in the war of words. And, of course, it goes alongside an actual military conflict. So it's quite a grave moment.
And, you know, interestingly enough, ABC News as well was reporting this morning issues about the Turkey-ISIS oil issue. And it was pretty interesting because they are now quoting people saying that the main arena, I guess you could say, for the ISIS oil is the West. They had someone who said they didn't want to name names. But what I really want to talk about is not whether the ISIS oil is sold in the West, but what do you make of the fact that almost all of the American media seems to be giving quite a bit of credibility to Vladimir Putin's claim about this when usually they're, you know, pretty skeptical?
Right. And of course, people in this country who are, you know, reasonably conscious know to be skeptical of the U.S. media, which is functioning more or less like a fourth branch of government. Of course, not WPFW, but the other big corporate chains. And so, you know, a month and a half ago when Russia started its air attacks into Syria, they were following the tenor and the politics of the Obama administration and saying that it was doomed to fail, it was disastrous. And then, of course, after the attacks on Paris, the Obama administration shifted its rhetoric considerably around the Russian intervention, calling it welcomed, that they want a collaboration. And so now for the U.S. media to essentially be repeating or giving some credence to Putin's accusations against Turkey, it reflects the broader sea change in U.S. politics towards Russia, at least. If not yet towards the Syrian government, at least towards the Russian government, seeing it more as a partner. Now, they have a contradiction in that Turkey is a member of NATO, and NATO is fundamentally an anti-Russian alliance. So they have to be able to say, on one hand, we stand by Turkey, we corroborate Turkey's evidence, we say that Turkey has a right to defend its airspace, and yet, on the other hand, usually with anonymous officials, perhaps from the security establishment, they're saying, well, Russia's actually right about what Turkey's doing. So they're saying both things. On one hand, they sort of have to, I think, as part of NATO, but I think they're also quite frustrated with Turkey because Turkey is serving as an obstruction to the potential evolving relationship with Russia, which they now think is necessary in order to contain or ultimately go at ISIS. So that's the contradiction. And Turkey, I think, by shooting down the Russian plane, was very deliberately trying to sabotage the peace talks or the political transition talks in Vienna. And that can only, I would think, frustrate the U.S. on one hand, but they can't go out and openly break with Turkey because that would be basically breaking up NATO.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that schizophrenia, I think, is also seen with Germany sending the troops in. What I did want to get back to, though, is this issue of Germany and sort of the schizophrenia, because I wanted to at least mention that, is I had actually seen a report this morning that Germany said they would not do anything involving Assad, which sort of means they probably wouldn't collaborate with Russia. But you saw something different, actually.
Yes, over the weekend, the defense minister of Germany put out two statements that seemed to contradict each other. It said Assad must go was one thing, that he can't be part of the political process, and that there will be no collaboration with German military because that would, in their view, delegitimize the German military to the people of Syria. That was their words. And yet, on the other hand, there's another statement that says that there has to be some sort of political pause or a military pause with the Syrian government, and there has to be some relationship, a temporary alliance, they said. I mean, those are the actual phrase, a temporary alliance, because obviously they recognize that frigates and some airstrikes are not enough to defeat the Islamic State, whereas the Syrian military is a formidable and large ground force, in addition to the Kurds, of course, who are the main ground forces fighting the Islamic State. And so I think even these big international players with big air forces and so forth, they recognize that there has to be some sort of arrangement, some sort of understanding with the Syrian military if they are really going to escalate against the Islamic State. It might be a de facto pause or partnership, but it won't be perhaps as open. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the German high command could actually contradict itself within 48 hours shows that there's a lot of, I mean, you called it schizophrenia, a lot of contradictoriness involved in these international politics at this moment, because they're trying to sort of say one thing and do another, and ultimately, you know, you can't do that. At a certain point, you have to bring those two into harmony with one another.
And speaking of air forces, it looks like potentially tomorrow in the Parliament of the United Kingdom, they are going to vote on whether or not the English Air Force, if you will, the Royal Air Force, should get involved in this serious situation. It's a very, very big deal. Also, the sort of internal politics of the Labour Party with Jeremy Corbyn,
yes,
potentially being unseated over this, the coup of him. But I don't want – well, we can maybe talk about that a little bit. But let me say this about that. The most interesting thing I saw is that the case that David Cameron is making is that all they need is the British assistance along with all these other countries, because there's 70,000 quote-unquote moderate rebels that are ready to destroy the Islamic State, which I found to be – interesting, given that the United States just admitted they spent $500 million to train moderate rebels and train, like, what, like 12 guys?
Four or five, I think they
right,
said.
Four or five. So that's a big gap. What's going on here? I mean, are there 70,000 moderate rebels? And what is a moderate rebel? Because I think that's kind of – there's also a lot of shifting sands about what we mean by moderate, you know, reactionary, Islamicist, aggressive, extremist. I mean, there's just all these things thrown around. But what's going on?
Well, I wouldn't say that there never was any moderate rebel in Syria, but I think the sort of the there's a fictional character known as the moderate rebel that only exists in Western media and Western governments, which is, you know, that it's sustaining this sort of this notion that you can pour weapons, logistical support, and money into Syria, and it will not get in the hands of the most sophisticated military actors against the Syrian government, which are al-Nusra Front, also known as al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State. And so, look, 70,000 moderate rebels, it's obviously a lie. There are, of course, the Kurdish forces, which do have a secular and democratic perspective. But, you know, I think that the all the talk about, for instance, the Russian violation of Turkish airspace, no one's even pausing to think, well, what about the violation of Syrian airspace, which is what Britain and Germany and the U.S. are talking about. It's not like these governments are coordinating at all with the Syrian government. And so, you know, there's a grave international war crime actually being committed, and that's what the Syrian government has been saying for quite some time, that they'd be willing to cooperate with governments that are willing to cooperate with them. But now we're having all the capitals of Europe voting on, you know, bombing a part of Syria, entering yet another war next to Iraq. And so I think that the anti-war movement is having a large protest in England tomorrow against the pending British intervention. Of course, Jeremy Corbyn has come out and said that he's against the British intervention. So I think that those are things that the U.S. anti-war movement has to be looking towards as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, and I want to sort of maybe tie this Corbyn question in and the anti-war movement to American politics, because obviously I believe that Mr. Corbyn, who's the head of the Labour Party in England, had sent out a notice basically to all the members of the Labour Party saying, what do we want people to do? The vast majority of members seem to be opposed to any sort of intervention. But most of the what's known in England as the Parliamentary Labour Party, and I'm just explaining to our readers how this works, they are for intervention.
Yes.
And they are saying that if he doesn't give a free vote, which means you can do whatever you want, not vote with the party, on intervention in Syria so they can vote for it, they would use that to undermine him. And so both in England and in the United States, where there's quite a bit of anti-war sentiment, it doesn't really seem to be terribly largely reflected in the major political parties there. What do you make of that?
Well, in the United States, I think there's a large, large anti-war sentiment. If you remember back in September 2013, when the British government first tried to bomb Syria, and Cameron narrowly lost a vote, and then Obama kicked the can to Congress and said, if Congress supports it, then I would support it. At that point, the polls said that 70 to 80% of Americans opposed U.S. intervention in Syria. Now, we should also remember that that was a plan to bomb the Syrian government. And only 2 years later, now there's a de facto pause with the Syrian government to focus on the Islamic State. And back then, when the Syrian government was saying, all this is going to do is help the extremist actors in Syria, people said that Assad, like Gaddafi before him, was a conspiratorial madman. But putting all that aside, I think it does reflect there is a large anti-war sentiment. It hasn't been reflected in large anti-war mobilizations as of yet. But I do think it is a real political phenomenon in the United States, in that Obama and Clinton and even the Republicans are saying, well, we can't commit to large amounts of ground forces. Well, some Republicans, the sort of wingnut Republicans, but a lot of them are saying we can't commit to another large U.S. occupation. And the only reason they would say that, it's not because they care about the lives of U.S. soldiers. It's not because they care about the lives of Syrian people. It's because they consider it a huge political vulnerability to put large numbers of U.S. ground troops again in the Middle East. And that's a reflection of the wariness and the opposition to war inside the United States. So even though it hasn't yet manifested on the streets, I believe there's a very large anti-war sentiment in the country. And we in the Answer Coalition see that on our website and people sharing our statements against war and intervention, against sanctions and so forth. So I think that that's still a real factor in in Western Europe and here in the United States.
Do you think in the wake of, this is Dave Rabin, by the way, do you think in the wake of the Paris attacks that there's a large resistance in this country to air attacks on ISIS? I mean, I haven't seen those numbers. I mean, there seemed to be a fair amount of support for that particular thing. And I don't think anybody, certainly not Obama, is talking about an occupation of Syria. So what do you think about that?
Yes, I think you're, I mean, in the sense that also the drone attacks that have been going on in country after country for years, there's, you know, when unfortunately, when U.S. lives are not on the line as much, they don't get as much U.S. media coverage, and therefore that affects, I think, public sentiment, who just see this as some faraway war. It's a war where all the bleeding and dying happens on the other side, and so therefore people are able to accept that in larger numbers. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, as in the wake of 9/11, there obviously is a big pro-war boost or pro-military boost, and there are support for airstrikes that does exist. But I think the reason why, I guess the point, the reason why Obama is not talking about ground troops, because Bush could talk about ground troops and he could get support for that. The reason he can't is because people have the historical memory of Iraq.
I think he does too.
Yes, and he does too, I believe.
I mean, he was against Iraq from the get-go.
And we can't, and no one who's actually reading the news can forget, of course, how the Islamic State got started. And that was from the destruction of Iraq and the destruction of Syria. It's the constant regime change, the constant interventionist efforts that have led to the breakup of these unitary nation states, have fueled sectarian civil war, and have given free room for the Islamic State and al-Qaeda to grow, to recruit, to weaponize.
Yeah, and I mean, they're in all these different countries. I mean, there's all the information now about Libya, and I read something about Yemen now, even al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula being eclipsed by the Islamic State. I mean, to what extent do you think the Islamic State is also growing, because it seems like they're having success in, you know, I don't even really know how to term it, I guess expelling forces that many see as negative to the Muslim world? I mean, what's kind of behind a little bit of their growth? Because it just seems so spectacular that all these groups that have existed for 20 or 30 years are now going over to the Islamic State.
Yes, I think the fact that they've been able to secure territory is a big difference from, for instance, al-Qaeda, which does give them some attraction. They can say they are actively building a caliphate, which, you know, is not something al-Qaeda said that it was going to do in the near future. And I think the Islamic State also, and al-Qaeda and the others, they can make a case to many young and alienated Muslims across the West, and they can say, look, there's a war on all of our countries. Look what's happening in Yemen and Libya and Pakistan, Iraq. And they can list all the different countries where the West has been bombing with drones or intervening and occupying, and say there's a war on Islam. And, you know, if you have any manhood and if you have any righteousness in you, you will join to defend Islam. So I think that there is, obviously, there are compelling recruiters. That's the big worry within France and Belgium and England and to some extent the United States. There are lots of people who are going to fight, replenishing the ranks of the Islamic State. And I think that's why when people say the situation has to be resolved within the Muslim world, it's obviously true that the West cannot be the very force that created the Islamic State cannot be the one to resolve it, that it has to come from the forces in the region who are fighting the Islamic State and providing an alternative path that's not based on sectarianism, but that's based on unity, that's based on secularism, that's based on democratic principles, and based on anti-imperialism. Because if it's not based on anti-imperialism, you are going to have these forces that are going to kind of manipulate or co-opt the anti-imperialist sentiment and drive it towards these very reactionary organizations.
Well, it appears then that that is the political line, what you just stated of the potential resolution, that appears to be the political line of the Kurdish forces in Syria and at least the PKK forces in Iraq, of that sort of democratic, non-confessional orientation towards solving this conflict. How do you evaluate both that and the situation for the Kurds, which seems to have become much more complicated since this issue?
Well, the whole region is extremely complicated, and for the Kurdish struggle over decades has always been extremely complicated, played as they have been between many competing state actors. In the north of Syria, the Kurds have disjointed territories that are really separated by an area in the north central of Syria where there are many Turkmen villages. And in fact, this is part of what Turkey's intervention was about, was obviously preventing the space for the Kurdish areas to grow, for the Kurdish areas to also achieve more territory at the expense of the Islamic State. Actually, that is what Turkey's more afraid of than the Islamic State, which explains part of the contradictions of their policy. And then, yes, of course, the Kurdish forces represent a different sort of politics, and I would say even the Syrian state represents a different sort of politics, which is why even if not every person who is fighting, I don't think every person who is supporting the Assad government against the Islamic State was necessarily a big champion of Assad, but they recognize that the Syrian state as it was constituted has been able to integrate many different religious minorities, has a larger secular, democratic, pro-women's rights, you know, compared to what else exists in Syria. And therefore, you know, the forces, ironically, that have represented sort of national liberation and secularism and anti-imperialism in the Middle East and in Syria, the people who could actually take on the Islamic State, for years, the United States has been attacking them, attacking the Syrian state, and also, I would say, giving very half-hearted and contradictory support to the Kurds. For instance, this summer, while the U.S. says they're supporting the Kurds as the moderate element within the civil war, they also signed a very dirty quid pro quo deal with Turkey, which allowed, in exchange for Turkey giving the U.S. the ability to strike from Turkish air bases into Syria, they basically signed off on the Turkish war on the YPG in Syria and the Turkish war on the Kurds in northern Iraq, not to speak, of course, of the Turkish war on Kurds within their own borders, which has resulted in many, many deaths of the Kurdish people. So the Kurds have a very complicated struggle ahead of them. They've been able to very tactfully move from place to place and you know, sign deals in a way to survive. But yes, I think the reason why many people around the world are looking to join the Kurds or looking to the Kurds is because they have a different sort of political perspective, as opposed to the Islamic State,
and
radically different.
And what do you think about Hillary Clinton's plan for a no-fly? And I guess there's two competing no-fly zone proposals. Hillary
yes.
Clinton, who's saying that there should be a limited alliance with Russia for a no-fly zone, and Jeb Bush, who's saying there should be a no-fly zone essentially against Russia. So how do you evaluate those two no-fly zone proposals?
Well, right. I mean, I think that both no-fly zones exist in sort of a fictitious world right now. It all depends on how things are actually implemented. Because if you were to have a no-fly zone, for instance, like what Hillary Clinton is saying, that's going to prevent Russian and Syrian airplanes from going over. Because remember, the Islamic State does not have an air force. So who's that no-fly zone really aimed at. She says it would be to contain the situation and to also seal the Turkish border. But they've been saying that for a long time about how they're going to seal the Turkish border. And so it could actually just help the Islamic State or help the radical forces, because it would basically say the people who are bombing the Islamic State would no longer be able to. And it also could potentially bring the Western militaries and the NATO powers in direct conflict with Russia. And then you wouldn't just have Turkey shooting down one Russian plane, but you could have potentially larger conflagrations. So I think there's a big danger in that situation, a very big danger. And Jeb Bush's is even more provocative and reckless, you could say. So I think that, I think that the no-fly zone, it means war. I mean, a no-fly zone means, of course, there already is war, but it means a different type of war, because you can only enforce a no-fly zone by shooting down planes. The other thing to add is there already is a de facto no-fly zone in a way imposed by Russia, because it's moved its anti-aircraft weaponry into the Mediterranean. It says it will not allow a repeat of what happened with the Turkish shootdown. So right now, the only people who are in the skies of over northern Syria are going to be Russian and Syrian airplanes. So in a way, this is the U.S. policymakers saying, well, if we can't fly, we want to make sure you can't fly either.
It's a no-fly. It sounds like some commercial for an airline company.
Right.
Fly today. Or don't fly. So this is, it's blanked out for the holidays. But I'm just hearing from Eugene, I didn't understand that particular ripple that Hillary Clinton is talking about a no-fly zone in conjunction with the Soviets, with the Russians, which is a big difference between
big difference.
Her and because obviously that's exceedingly dangerous if you don't have some substantial coordination with the Russians. So, what do you think about that vis-a-vis Jeb Bush's proposal?
Right. Well, I guess you could say it's better than Jeb Bush's proposal. I mean, in the sense that we're talking about the largest militaries in the world potentially. Shooting at each other, that has, implications for World War III type scenarios, which of course is what everyone thought about. But there is what you could say, if there has been a new Cold War developing over the last year and a half, especially in the situation in the Ukraine, you could see that in the last month and a half, there's been a toning down of that, and that in a way, a warming of relations between U.S. and Russia.
Except the lights get turned out, right, in Crimea?
Right. So there's still major flashpoints of struggle between them, but the fact that they could have this different rhetoric, the fact that Hillary Clinton could even float this idea of a no-fly zone of cooperation with Russia, that Putin and Obama at the last meeting, they sat for 90 minutes and talked about what the political transition could be, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. That's what the whole thing is it leading to. Is it leading to a ceasefire that could begin talks of some sort of transition or the end of the civil war in Syria? John Kerry was saying before the shootdown of the Russian plane that could begin as early as January 1st, but now this has been complicated, which I think, again, goes back to what Turkish motivations were. I shouldn't say Turkish motivations, the Turkish government's motivations. In Turkey, there is a very large movement of anti-war activists, of leftists, of Kurds who are against the Turkish government and believe the Turkish government is really not acting in the interests of the Turkish people.
Yes, and we should say that, in fact, there were two opposition journalists who were actually just imprisoned in Turkey because they reported a story in the main opposition newspaper about Turkish arms shipments going to Syria that they believe, they didn't have full confirmation, were actually going to the Islamic State directly.
They had photographs.
And they've been put in prison. And I was reading an article about it. There are also people who had some beef with Erdogan prior to this, so he'd been gunning for them for some time. So the final piece I want to try to touch on too here, which is related because the refugee crisis has become so big. Mm-hmm. So on the 29th, just a couple days ago, the EU has paid Turkey $3 billion to stop the quote unquote, stop the flow of refugees, basically arrest a lot more people and put them in camps that Europe is going to pay for. Does this have any, it seems like it just, everyone knows that the reason why it's happening is because there's a war in Syria. And it seems like right now the Europeans are trying to pay blood money to Turkey as essentially giving in to the anti-refugee sentiment. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the attacks on the Muslim and the refugees and the immigrant communities across Europe and here in the United States that happened after the Paris attacks, were immediately registered even among sort of European social democratic leaders. And I think it's good to call it blood money. I think that's correct. Of course, Turkey says that they want to create a safe zone where then they can unlock that money and start to help the refugees within Syria. It's also the position of, like, you know, Donald Trump and a lot of the Republican candidates. But, you know, I think that that is a it again shows the sort of duplicity of the Turkish government, because it's obviously trying to continue to wage its war against the Syrian government. It's not trying to wind down the Syrian civil war. It's actually trying to escalate it or to hamper the peace talks by shooting down the Russian plane. And yet at the same time, there's millions of refugees who have entered Turkey. And so, you know, the Turkish government should be trying to actually help the refugee situation by helping the political resolution inside of Syria, but instead they've been obstructing it.
So a lot of people have pointed out in the wake of the Iranian nuclear deal that there has been at least some possibility that there could be some sort of realignment from the U.S. in terms of their allies in the region. So Turkey, NATO member, big U.S. ally, seems to be doing everything possible to frustrate what the United States is trying to do. Saudi Arabia, same thing. Mm-hmm. And these are maybe the two biggest U.S. clients outside of Israel in the area, or allies, however you want to deem it. Does that sort of portend that this, I would say, sort of stillborn, broader change between the U.S. and Iran could actually now become a much more real thing when you've got the Iraqi government others that are also friends of the United States sort of arguing for this change in course?
Right. I think that's the looming question in the sort of global politics and the region, especially right now. Saudi Arabia, which has not committed anything to the fight against Islamic State for obvious reasons, right? Who the Islamic State, how it got started, its ideological affinities with Saudi Arabia. Instead, it's waging a war on Yemen and is using it sort of as a proxy for its larger competition with Iran. I don't see like an immediate shift in U.S. global politics. But obviously, I think the United States looks at Iraq and they look at Syria and they look at Afghanistan, actually, also the places where the U.S. has been attacking, and they realize it's impossible to put the pieces back together without Iran there and without Iran supporting it, because Iran has larger regional influence. So I think that there's also a struggle within the U.S. political and military establishment. There are people who are very close to Israel and very close to Saudi Arabia who are deathly afraid of any sort of realignment or global shift towards Iran. From Iran's part, you know, we should remember, even though it's had an anti-colonial revolution and has very much defended its national independence, I think it would be open to such a realignment. And so that's why Israel and Saudi Arabia is afraid. That would also probably calm things with Russia. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that are up in the air right now, but it represents, I think, a larger shift of global politics. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States has been the unipolar force in global politics and military power. It said that it will do anything to prevent a second power from ever arising. It went to war with multiple sovereign independent states in order to really prove its military superiority. But now we're dealing with the blowback from that, the backlash, and that is that you can perhaps destroy the world and rule the world by yourself, but if you actually want to put things back together, you have to work with other players. And so that's why there has been a larger interest within the State Department and the military towards, I think, working informally and perhaps formally with even the Iranian military in Syria and in Iraq.
Well, let me ask you this as an anti-war activist, and we were actually talking, Dave and I, with Andrew Basevich not that long ago about the Vietnam War era teach-ins. We're in the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the teach-ins in the Vietnam War, which really kicked off the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War movement. So what do you see as the tasks or the importance, as someone, again, who is an anti-war activist with the Answer Coalition, in terms of, you know, building up that kind? I mean, do you see that 50-year anniversary as something that is, you know, instructive in terms of what folks should be doing?
Yes, absolutely. I think that we have to remember, when the Vietnam War started, most Americans couldn't locate Vietnam on a map and wouldn't have known much about Vietnam at all. And so a big part of the anti-war movement was obviously to agitate against the U.S. military, to show, why are the Vietnamese people our enemies? Why are we fighting a so-called war against communism for people who have independently chosen their political destiny? What does that have to do with jobs and racism and all the attacks on the U.S. working class? Why is that our fight? And so I think the anti-war movement in the United States has historically played an extremely important role in refocusing people to say, who are your real enemies? And that is extremely relevant today. But as in the early 60s, we have to also be explaining the actual history of the Middle East. How did the Middle East get to this point? You know, I teach history, and we have students who are 18, 19 years old who, from when they were small children, there's been a war on Afghanistan. The Iraq War is something that's sort of in their distant past to them now. And so we have to be able to go back and explain what happened to the Middle East, why was it targeted, how was it destroyed, and how does it how did it end up where it is today? And also, I think, you know, to reiterate the basic principles that we have more in common, really, with the people of Syria, the people of Iraq, the Kurdish people, the people of Turkey, than we do with the people who are waging these wars on the Pentagon, the military contractors, and so forth.
You know, it's funny that you said the importance of the role of the anti-war movement, and it just reminded me, this is a little esoteric, but of a quote, a famous quote in Arthur Schlesinger's 1,000 Days about the John F. Kennedy administration. He unearthed a diary entry from Kennedy at the end of World War II. He said, the only way war can end is when the conscientious objector is as honored as the war veteran is today. What do you think about that?
That's absolutely correct. And you think about Bertolt Brecht, or I'm going to, you know, massacre his own words because he's a beautiful poet and playwright. But he talked about how the most powerful weapons in the world are nothing without someone to shoot them. Mm-hmm. And you know, what good is your tank if you don't have anyone willing to drive it? And I think that that's obviously a big role, is to bring back that sentiment, bring back that legacy and tradition, which is strong and exists in the United States, an anti-war sentiment, even from within the ranks of the U.S. military. That was what made Muhammad Ali so heroic to so many people, was his willing to sacrifice his own standing, his own position and prestige in order to stand on principle. And I think that the anti-war movement brings that out of people, and the anti-war movement can inspire many soldiers and active service members to do the same.
And, you know, I think it's important that we touch on that. And the reason I was leading into that is that these stations were WPFW, 89.3 FM, Jazz and Justice Radio, part of the Pacifica Radio Network, started by Mr. Lewis Hill mm-hmm. in 1947, a conscientious objector who wanted this to be a whole range of listener-supported stations for that very reason, that the influence and the power of war in the military-industrial complex can be such that only something that those who are peace-loving and conscious people will supporting with their own money, that's the only way it can survive. So once again, I just want to encourage folks, go to WPFWFM.org, become a member, become a sustaining donor, and allow us to keep bringing you all of the information, all of the great shows, all of the great music that you get every day. And I just think it's very apropos. We're talking about war issues when that was a key focus of why, you know, we set this up. And I want to move on to that. Here we are in Washington, D.C. I mean, how much do you view the sort of wars and things like that happening abroad as really being issues of just the greed of the military-industrial complex? Or is there something a little more fundamental to, is it just a warlike country, as many say? I mean, what is it really? Is it the money? Is it the attitudes? What is it?
It's an empire. And the U.S. is the heart of a global empire, and it has been since the end of World War II. It's been trying to arrange military, economic, and political affairs around the world to keep a certain world order, in which the United States is obviously the top dog financially and militarily. Its military is the size of the next 10 militaries put together. The amount of money that the tax dollars are spending on weapons and things that can only destroy human life are enormous. And so, of course, the tendency towards war is built into the maintenance of an empire, because whenever you have an empire, people are going to resist it in many different ways. They're going to fight for independence. They're going to create governments that will challenge an empire. And so you need to have a club to keep people in order. You know, they have lots of soft power. They have corporations. They have a banking system. But ultimately, none of that can exist unless you have a club behind it.